Well, without further delay, it's a real blessing to have Brother Harry Wildblood serving us again. We've always received rich blessings, encouragement, and feelings of spiritual enthusiasm from his services in the past. And today he'll be speaking to us on the topic of the cries of the reapers. The cries of the reapers. Brother Harry.
Well, good morning, brother. We're very pleased to be here with our dear brother. And we had a wonderful night of fellowship and hospitality at the Martin home, Brother Russ and Sister Camille and family. Our topic today is the cries of the reapers. This is actually a very thrilling topic. It has to do with economics and some of the things. And actually, Sister Karen asked me, when are you going to be giving this talk? And I said, why do you ask? She says, well, if it's after lunch, that's not so good because I used to fall asleep in economics every day after lunch. But no, we're going to start out with this. And really what we're going to see from the cries of the reapers is this is one of the vital components used in God's plan to bring about the ends of destroying the church-state system, Christendom. It wasn't going to happen just by a few events. It was going to be a collection of world events. The entire world and the entire economy of the world was going to be brought together to bring about God's plan. This was something that was absolutely unstoppable. What we like to do is talk about the dynamics of this. Brother Russell, when he talks about this, he brings out the Zephaniah scripture, neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath. And he also says, so we're going to be talking about gold and silver, but he also talks about the thoughtful student of history. And what we want to do, since history is in the past, it's recorded, we can look at it, take a look at those historical events, the things that took place regarding both silver and gold, and we're going to see how these were used as assets to bring about the ends of God's plan. And not just the destruction of Christendom, we're going to see some really good news at the end of this, which I really appreciate. Well, this is based on James 5:9. Go to, now ye rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Ye have heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the Lord of Sabbath. ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton, but behold, now the judge standeth at the door. This day of judgment, where the sins of the past, the sins of Christendom, they would all be judged during that time. This is what's happening. And when we think of this prophecy, we have to realize this is a prophecy of the last days. The day of the Lord begins in 1874. We find very soon after that we're going to have the plagues coming on upon Christendom, bringing upon the time of trouble, the battle of Armageddon, the destruction of Christendom. And when I say Christendom, I'm talking about Christendom as Brother Russell defines it on page 254 of the first volume. And this mixed system, church and state, the church nominal, wedded to the kingdoms of this world, which the Lord calls Babylon, confusion, presumes to call itself Christendom or Christ's kingdom. So we're talking about the church-state system, which was destroyed in the 1914-1918 period. In order for this to happen, it was going to require an upheaval of society. And if you're going to upheave something, you have to get down to its very foundation and turn it over. That's the whole idea of upheaval. Now, in Volume 4, Brother Russell talks about this aspect of it in the chapter, The Cries of the Reapers. Now, this also brings to mind other scriptures that are brought out very prominently in Volume 4. Zephaniah 3:8, therefore wait upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the people, assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. Well, how is this going to be done? God would use this economic linkage, because he had linked together, Christendom had linked together all the nations of the world, essentially through colonization. They had trade relationships and government relationships with all the nations of the world. They become economically linked, and God was going to use this linkage to shake the entire world. Now, as we go through this study, we want to keep some questions in mind. What was the most stable element of society? Because if you're going to have an upheaval, you're going to have to get down to that most stable foundation. What happened to them? How did it happen? Were they alone in this? Were other people involved in this as well? Did the politicians or kings know what was happening? Did they try to provide aid? Could they fix it once they found the problem? Could they say, oh, that's no problem. Let's just fix that. Because after all, we want to do good things for our citizens. Who actually did it to them? How did this come about? How did the monetary system work? What was the ultimate result? How did this affect Christendom? Was there an upside to this? Was there some good news that comes out of this? Was there actually justice in this? And what about today? What do we see happening today? So as we go through this, we see that the most stable part of society was farmers, agriculture. They create value out of their land and labor. That's basically what it is. It was really the foundation of civilization, the foundation of Christendom. What does agriculture give us? It gives us food, grain, vegetables, meats, fruit, etc. Clothing, flax, wool, cotton. All these necessities of life. Also transportation. For centuries and centuries, if you're going to have any transportation, it's going to be horses. If you needed extra power, you're going to use oxen. It's all agricultural products. That's where all the value essentially came from. That had been this way for centuries and centuries and centuries. In fact, in 1405, there's a book called The Book of Hours written by commissioned by the Duke of Berry. And it has many, many pictures just like this. And you can see here's agriculture. Here's all the picture of the farmer in his field. This is the foundation for what? Here's the king in his castle. You find many, many pictures just like this. So agriculture is the foundation of wealth and stability. So the most stable element is the farmers. Because the farmer can create these products from the land and his work, he is traditionally not greatly affected by changes in government policies, etc., because he's creating the wealth at his own home, essentially. For centuries, farmers could essentially be independent of the rest of society, except for some necessities, and they'd sell some of their farm products to purchase whatever those necessities are. The farmer was typically not rich, but he had a stable life. He was producing food. He had food, he had clothing, he had shelter. Now, farm production for centuries and centuries was limited due to limited technology, limited equipment and techniques, and also transportation. They couldn't take these massive farm produce and carry it across the ocean. It just wasn't practical. Transportation had not caught up. So their markets were typically local markets. But with the time of the end and the increase of knowledge, this began to change. And the time of the end, beginning in 1799, marked in scripture by Napoleon's Egyptian campaign, these changes were coming. We had wars, draft, education, the Industrial Revolution. And with the wars in the United States and Europe in the 19th century, this brought soldiers in from all walks of life through a draft. They would come into the armies. They had to have some rudimentary education, but they were all benefited by that education. And they were exposed to new ideas, new principles, things they'd never seen before. Farmers were exposed to new opportunities and techniques. And with Daniel 12:4, the time of the end, knowledge would increase and man would travel to and fro. And this to and fro, this means transportation. This means that markets then can come together through the use of trains and barges. These are photos from the 1880s. Steam trains, steam barges. Also shipping. There was a movement in the middle part of the 19th century to go from sail to steam. The Cutty Sark, a very famous ship, that was really the last commercial clipper ship for cargo. And in the 1860s and 70s and then on, steam. This is what you found, the big steamships. They were much more reliable, much more dependable. So the world quickly became smaller as the steamships crossed the seas in a fraction of the time that it took for sail. Thus, the ships brought countries and people closer together and made them dependent economically on one another. How did this affect the farms? Well, for the farmers, they could now export grain. They could sell cotton and wheat on an international market, international trade. But when you're in an international market, Now you have international competition. So they were competing with Europe, Argentina, India, Australia, Russia, Pakistan, China, etc. And when you're competing in these huge markets, now all of the prices and the markets are linked. In other words, they have to accept the international price. So what effect did this have on the farmers of U.S. versus the United States versus Europe? Well, in the United States, the farms were typically large. They were family-owned farms. But in Europe, there were smaller farms that were rented. And what was happening in Europe is the folks who were the landowners, they would rent the land to the farmers, and the farmers would sell their crops in order to pay rent. So the crop, the sale of the crop is where the livelihood came from. Now, if you look in 1873, prices were essentially good, sales were good, life was pretty good. We take a look at what their trade consisted of. They would grow their crops, sell the crops. They grow the crops, sell the crops, they would receive their international price, which is typically in silver, which was monetized everywhere. This was money everywhere. They'd receive this price, and then they'd have to buy their farm equipment, typically manufactured goods. And they just go through this cycle, buy the equipment when they need it. But in the middle 1870s, things began to change. In fact, in 1874, we see that what happens is farm prices gradually began to fall for the farmers in U.S., Canada, and Europe, and then the prices began to plummet. Wheat prices fell by 53% from 1873 to 1896 in the United States, and in England, they fell by 61% from 73 to 94. Just think of this. The most stable part of society, they found their livelihood being sucked away, sucked dry. Just think, if you had a business, if you have a business and you find in less than 20 years the price of your product drops by 53%, what is that going to do to your business? I mean, bring it home to roost in your business, in your household. That's just going to be terrible. Well, this price drop for folks in America, this was a crisis. For the smaller European farmer who rented his farm with the sale of his crops, this was devastating. What was the cause of that? Well, that was a good question. And in later in 1894, a fellow named Robert Lindblom in the Chicago Board of Trade, he was looking at this. A lot of folks were saying, well, it's just overproduction. I mean, we've got all these good farm implements now, and tractors are coming out, and et cetera. So production is just so much greater, and macroeconomic policies, if you have more goods, the price goes down, supply and demand. So he looks at this, and he finds out in 1883, there was about 1.565 million bushels of produced. 10 years later, it goes down by 5%. Production is actually down. Population is increasing. Demand is going up. But the prices are still about half of what they were 20 years earlier. So there must be something else going on. What that something else was a manipulation of the money supply itself. This affected the value of money itself and what it could buy. Now, before we go on to some of these specifics in history, let's talk about some of the basic principles of what gives your money value. Well, it turns out if you look at money and value, if we have our money supply over here and our goods and services, as long as you have a good balance between the money supply and the goods and services so that they're pretty much equal, as they both increase together, you have them going up this line and you have price stability. Your money is always worth essentially the same thing. But if there's an imbalance, for instance, if you have a lot more money all of a sudden thrown into your economy and the goods and services do not increase, the goods and services are here and the money and supply is way up there, what will happen is you're going to have inflation. Prices are going to rise. In fact, in other words, you can say, well, we have so much money and it's being apportioned to just a few goods and services, so every one of the goods and services, the cost is going up. Well, this is kind of like sailors on payday. You know, they get all this money and it's burning a hole in their pocket. And they don't care what things cost. They just buy it. So you'll find when people on payday, prices will all rise. They realize you got a lot more money for a few days in the economy. Well, history saw this actually happen in It turns out in the years between 1532 and 1540, Spain looted Inca gold in the New World, and they brought it back to Europe. Hundreds of tons of gold, thousands of tons of silver. But they didn't bring back any more goods and services. They didn't bring back furniture and clothing and things for people to buy. All they brought back was gold and silver to be used as money. So what was the net of the same GNP in Europe? What happened? Inflation. You had more money. Nothing more to buy, but more money to buy it with, so prices rose. Well, what about the reverse? Well, if your money supply is small, but the goods and services are very large, what will happen is you'll have deflation. Prices are going to have to get smaller and smaller because your goods and services are keep competing for fewer and fewer dollars. And if this is persisted in, what will happen is depression. Depression is where you have virtually no money in the economy. Prices are very low. Unemployment gets very high, and the economy essentially grinds to a halt. Well, who's affected and how are they affected? Well, when money is scarce, in this deflation or depression, prices fall. Now, the bankers or lenders, actually, they can be happy about this because they see their dollars becoming, since they have the ownership of the vast majority of the wealth, they see their dollars getting more and more valuable with time. And as folks are repaying their loans, every dollar they pay back is more valuable than when they lent it out. However, if you're a farmer, you're a borrower. You have to live on credit. If you borrow $100 today and you pay it back in 5 years, but those dollars in 5 years are much more valuable and harder to come by, while your crop prices are going down, it's going to break your back. And this is essentially what was happening. Now, in order to set the scene for what was happening in Brother Russell's day, we have to actually go back to the Civil War. For the Civil War, in order to fight the Civil War, President Lincoln realized, we don't have enough money to do this. We don't have enough of gold and silver to do this. But the government was authorized to make money itself. It was authorized to coin money and print money. So what he did is he said, all right, what we're going to do is we're going to print greenbacks, they were called. They're going to be legal tender. We're going to print $450 million of these. And they're really not going to be backed up by gold or silver. They're going to be backed up by trust in the government initially. That was the whole idea. Well, this was considered inflationary because all it was dumping a lot more money in the economy, except the government was printing it and spending it themselves first, so they could use this to fund the war. Well, the bankers absolutely hated this. The financiers hated this. In fact, there are rumors that the assassination of Lincoln was actually motivated by some of the financiers in England. Of course, there are a lot of rumors about why Lincoln was assassinated. But after he's gone, because he felt, well, as the economy grows, which they saw the economy growing, as it grows, it needs more money in it to keep it healthy. Well, others didn't agree with him, so in 1866 they passed a Contraction Act, and what that did is it systematically removed money from the money supply. It removed these greenbacks. So what we find happening between 1866 and 1886, these are the millions of dollars in the economy. We had $1.8 billion in circulation, and by the 20 years we went down to $400 million. That's a contraction of 78%. So what was happening is that actually the lifeblood of the economy was being sucked dry. This is actually very similar to the Dark Ages. In the Dark Ages, the landowners, the kings, the nobles, they had money, but the common man didn't have any. And they thought, well, what do you need money for? You know, you're a serf, you're working on the farm. You need something, we'll get it for you. You don't need any money. So what they saw was the economy was really starting to grind to a halt as money was extracted from it. The historians call the period that resulted, really from 1873 to 1896, they call it the Long Depression. This was the largest depression in the history of mankind up to this time. Why? Because he had restitution. Goods and services were increasing. Productivity, the GDP was up 6% per year. Because they had machines and factories. What a machine and a factory could do in a day would be equivalent to what a man could do in a year. So productivity was skyrocketing, but the money supply was lagging. Prices were falling by 1% to 3% per year. The 3% is in farm prices, and we'll see a little more about that very soon. And unemployment reached levels of 20 to 30% at times during that period. So keep in mind what money was, what people considered really to be money. Money was gold and silver. This is an 1873 silver dollar. Here's an 1874 gold dollar. You're probably never going to see one of these because a lot of these were melted down for the silver in them, actually, because silver prices were very high at that time. But this is what they felt money was. So if this is what money is, and you need to get more money into your economy, this means that the money supply was dependent upon finding gold and silver. So you can say, well, what controlled your money supply? How could you increase your money supply? Well, here's how. Here's your Alan Greenspan back in the 1870s and 1880s. You had to find it, find this money, because people wanted money they could bite. Here's an 1878 silver dollar. They wanted something you could bite. They wanted something that had a ring to it. They didn't want a flimsy piece of paper. They didn't have trust in that. So they depended upon this guy finding gold. Well, as he finds gold and large operations find gold, they're going to bring their little bags of gold dust and try to use that for money. Well, one of the problems with that is there's no standard here. In fact, it turns out in the 1800s, saloon keepers would try to hire the biggest, burliest guys they could with big monster hands. And when guys would come in, the miners would come in with their bags of gold dust to buy a drink in the saloon, the guys would take a pinch. Well, you want to get the guys with the biggest fingers possible, and they would just come in there like a steam shovel and take the pinch for the drink. Because they weren't stupid. The saloon owners weren't stupid. Well, how do you actually get that into a money supply in a standard way? What you have to, from this gold rush, you actually have to mint it. So there was pressure to build mints in Carson City and San Francisco. And there was a time when you could actually take your gold to the mint, they would assay it, and if that had enough gold in it, they could take it, you know, do the little refining process, and they could actually mint the dollars for you, mint the silver eagles for you. So you independently, as an independent citizen with a bag of gold, you can affect the money supply. You can actually bring that in, and you can make the money yourself. But they figure, well, that's okay because it took work for this guy to dig the gold out. So, I mean, so this money is the kind they wanted. The value of the money, of the metal in it, actually backed it up. And this was really independent of any government. You take that amount of gold anywhere in the world, it was essentially worth the same. So that's the whole idea of the gold standard and the silver standard. Well, finally, what happens in 1897? In 1897 is when the fourth volume came out, by the way. What happens is the Long Depression ends. Well, why does it end? Well, it turns out the Klondike Gold Strike in 1897, they found a huge gold strike that dumped all this extra gold into the world's economy. Also, South African gold was found. And plus a cyanidization process, it's a potassium and sodium cyanide, you dissolve gold ore in that, and it can extract 10 times more gold out of the ore than they were able to in the past. So all of a sudden the money supply goes up. Prices stabilize. Sounds like really good news, doesn't it? Gee, maybe Brother Russell missed something because the fourth volume came out in 1897, right when this was ending, and he'd already written about things in the past. Well, actually, Brother Russell didn't miss a thing. He was right on the money. Because although there was a lot of good news, the economy was doing better, it didn't help the farmers much at all. They were the hardest hit. Their prices were still down in both the U.S. and Christendom. Why is this? What is happening? Well, for this, we have to go back to 1872. This is when the gold and silver standard was established. Alexander Hamilton, a brilliant man, a brilliant statesman, established the bimetallic standard where 16 ounces of silver is equal to 1 ounce of gold. This was by law, and this was the ratio in 1873. A $1 coin in it had $1 of gold or $1 of silver. And the international gold and silver prices supported that. That's right essentially where they were hovering. So that worked fine. But then, this was going to change. In 1874, we had the first results of the Coinage Act of 1873, in which all of a sudden this act says we're not going to make silver dollars anymore. Essentially, silver was now demonetized. When it's demonetized, that means a farmer or somebody or a miner cannot bring his silver into the mint and mint dollars out of it. In the past, they could do that. They could bring in their silver, bullion, or whatever, have the mint mint it, and they could create money themselves, just like with gold. But once it becomes demonetized, it's not legal tender anymore. Silver has now become a commodity. So now the silver value floats with supply and demand. And the demand is now down because there's no demand to mint it into coins anymore. So what happens? Silver prices drop. So as we track the silver prices, we'll see that in 1873, before 1873, the silver prices were a little above $1.30 an ounce. And keep in mind, for a silver dollar like I have in my hand, this silver dollar, this is not an ounce. This is less than an ounce. And whether it's 1873 silver dollar or later, this is the same weight, and it's a little less than an ounce. But the price of silver itself went from $1.30 an ounce in 1873 down to 68 cents in 1896. This is the period of the Long Depression, which you can see. But the silver prices have dropped by 48%. Now notice, this Long Depression is over, but the silver prices are still very low. Silver price is still very low. And they more or less, they're right in this area, and they never rise up to their previous levels. The silver, this is the money the farmers were receiving for their crops. This is one of the main points. So they're receiving less and less value because they're selling it on the international market. We want to see that a little more. So you might ask, well, why would anybody want to demonetize silver? Oh, by the way, this tracks all the way up to 1914. You see all the way up here, farmers are herding the whole way up through 1914. Well, why demonetize silver? Well, if you're a manufacturer, you want to buy the raw materials and sell manufactured goods. Well, if you're a manufacturer, especially in England had really had the lion's share of manufacturing in the world, which we'll see. You like to buy the raw materials, which are mainly agricultural products, and you want to sell them at a higher price. Well, England had a relative monopoly on many manufactured goods, which they sold for gold, because England was on a gold standard, which began in 1816. Then they would use this gold that they would receive, they'd buy silver, use that to trade for raw materials. And as long as England had a good manufacturing base, or as close to a monopoly as they could get, they could buy the raw materials cheap and sell the finished goods at a premium. What we'd like to do is look a little more closely at England and how England operated. In the earlier years, in the early 1800s, England had a textile monopoly. Essentially, what they would do is they would buy cotton and other fibers from farm products all around the world, and then they would sell cloth and clothing. They would sell that at a premium. So they had demonetized silver in 1816, so they could buy the cotton for silver, buy the cotton or whatever fiber for silver, but then they would sell the cloth and the clothing for gold. England is one of the smartest nations as far as economics and the way they operate. If we track their relative share in manufacturing, this is before the first Industrial Revolution. Here's the United Kingdom here, and here's the United States. Back in 1750, I mean, we're the tiny little minnow in a big pond. That's what we are. But the United Kingdom is not prominent either. There are other countries that had much more manufacturing. But with time, by 1800, England had realized that the way to really conquer is not just militarily, you have to do that economically and industrially as well. So their prominence starts increasing. By 1830, they clearly had the lion's share, but you notice the colonies are starting to come up here. By 1860, United Kingdom, I mean, they've much more than the rest of the world. But notice the United States. The United States is now a country, and they're competing on the same level as all the major nations of Europe. By 1860, you'll find, wow, the United States, it's starting to be a threat. In 1860, you've got this huge country across the ocean with tremendous land and resources, capability, ingenuity, industriousness. So, by what does this mean? Well, what does England want to do about this? Well, England says, gee, you know, we've got this manufacturing competition, and these competitors have both a gold and a silver standard. They can undercut England. They can take either gold or silver for their goods. They don't care. Well, what would England do? Well, England might say, well, gee, we can cut our prices. But you know what? That's not the English way. They're not going to cut their prices. But what they can do is, what if they could get their competitors to raise their prices? That way they'd be on parity with England. England could still make tremendous profits. Well, that's exactly what they did. They made their competition raise its prices without their competition even knowing it. And the way they did that was by make their competitors demonetize silver too. That way silver prices would be depressed, it would keep gold prices high, and make the silver cheaper. So when manufacturing goods were sold by the nations of Europe, they required gold for it, the same thing that England did. So England influenced all of its competitors to demonetize silver, so that by the end of the 1870s, you see, Germany was the first. Here's the United States in 1873. All the nations of Europe had demonetized silver. They're now on a gold standard. And silver prices plummeted. Well, how did this affect the farmers, the reapers of the United States and Christendom? Well, their trade had now changed. When they would grow their crops, they would sell their crops, and they would receive silver, same amount of silver as before, except this was now a commodity. They'd have to take the silver and sell it, and now they get half as much value in gold because silver had lost its value. Silver is only a commodity. The gold is now considered money, and they can use that to buy the manufactured goods. So the fact that farmers needed the manufactured goods in order to compete, they'd have to go through the cycle, and every time they did, they'd lose 50 cents on the dollar. This is what was really why they were crying. And this is just to stay competitive. To stay competitive, you go back to the 1870s, you got the wooden plow. Eventually, the iron plow came out, which is brittle and would break. But then the steel plow in the 1850s and later. This is what it took to actually compete in agriculture. It would go from horsepower in the 1870s to steam power. This is a tractor in the 1880s. In order to really compete on the world market, this is what it took. Now, you're not going to go in your barn and make your own steam tractor. You have to buy these manufactured goods. You have to buy these with gold, even though you're getting silver for your crops. So the overall effect on farming, the foundation of society, was the cries of the reapers, the demonetization of silver. For the American farmer, this was a very hard situation. For the European farmer, it was devastating. It shook Christendom to the bone. Well, you might ask, okay, here are these things happening. I thought they had government leaders. They had kings, they had presidents, and you know, prime ministers, and et cetera. Where was the government in all this? Didn't they know what was going on? Why would they let this happen? Did the politicians really understand? Well, these are quotes that Brother Russell has in the fourth volume. Senator Thurman, when the bill was pending in the Senate, we thought it was simply a bill to reform the mint, regulate coinage, and fix up one thing and another. And there's not a single man in the Senate, I think, unless a member of the committee from which the bill came, who had the slightest idea that was even a squint toward demonetization. So the folks who are passing the bill, the vast majority didn't even read it because they thought, oh, well, this is a bill about, you know, fixing some equipment in the mint and sweeping the floors and a few, you know, mechanical repairs, and that's about it. They didn't even read it for the most part, but it was a bill which would change the economic landscape for the vast majority of the civilized world, both in the United States and the same things happening in Europe. Senator Beck, he says, if the bill demonetizing silver, demonetizing silver never was understood by either House of Congress. I said it with full knowledge of the facts. Not even newspaper reporters, and they're the most vigilant men I ever saw obtaining information, discovered that it had been done. Not even the folks in the newspapers really researched this. Everybody thought it was just another routine bill. So it's just slid under the radar. Colonel Ingersoll, I do ask for the remonetization of silver. Silver was demonetized by fraud. It was an imposition upon every solvent man, a fraud upon every honest debtor in the United States. It assassinates labor. It was done in the interest of avarice and greed and should be undone by honest men. Senator Vance, I appreciate what he says. He said, the power of money and its allies throughout the world have entered into this conspiracy to perpetrate the greatest crime of this or any age. This was known as the crime of 1873. If you look that up on the web, you'll get hundreds and hundreds of hits. That's how it was known, the crime of 1873. To overthrow one half of the world's money and thereby double their own wealth by enhancing the value of the other half, which is in their hands. And this was very, very important because the financiers in England, they really had a control of the gold supply in the world. They really had. And what the idea is that silver was becoming so abundant with the, silver strike? Comstock load. Was one where tremendous amounts of silver was being poured into the economy, and they could not corner the market. But if we could get rid of that, of silver, demonetize that, they could really control the gold, corner the gold market, which is really what they're trying to do. So you say, well, what about the kings? I mean, we're looking at the politicians of the United States, and that's just in the colonies, you know, elected officials, and what do they know? Well, how about the kings? Because after all, the kings, they're the ones who are ruling but with divine right, right? They're the ones who have divine wisdom to control their countries. Or at least that's what they're telling everybody. Well, Prince Bismarck, he says, I am too old to go to school over that currency issue, but I recognize that although I acted in 1873 on what I regarded as the best advice, my action was too precipitate. In other words, it was too fast in view of the results which have followed. The one class we cannot afford to estrange is the farming class. And he really nailed it. The effect of this, even though this long depression was over in 1897 for everybody else, for the farmers, they were still hurting. And they would continue hurting and hurting and hurting all the way up through 1914. So the confidence in the purple, the confidence in the divine right of kings, it's slipping. They're realizing that their government leaders, they really don't have the clue. They really don't have all the answers for them. They really cannot bless them. Well, once the governments understood this, did they provide the necessary help? Well, in this country, they had what's called the Bland-Allison Act in 1878. This is an 1878 silver dollar, the one I have in my hand here. And the reason why this exists is because of the Bland-Allison Act. These things had stopped being minted, but they realized that the money supply was in such bad shape that they needed to get something more into the money. Well, people didn't want paper money. They didn't believe in it. Well, let's coin silver. So they said, well, let's remonetize silver. We're going to mint silver dollars. But actually, they weren't considered legal tender. You can only pay any debt with $5 worth of silver dollars. Why? Because there wasn't a dollar's worth of silver in it anymore. Some amount of silver as 20 years earlier, but the silver prices had dropped. So by 1896, we'll see the amount of silver in a silver dollar is worth about 50 cents. So this means that if you were a farmer and you got silver from your sale of crops, you get all this silver. Well, you couldn't use it as money, and you couldn't mint silver dollars out of it. Because when you took it to the mint, you say, I've got some silver, I want to make silver dollars. So you give them 50 cents worth of silver and you get a dollar back. No, you can't do that. Only the government can do that. And that's what the government was doing. So they're putting more money into the money supply for commerce, but this was not helping the farmer at all. If we track the silver prices from 1873 to 1896, we'll see it goes from a dollar and really in 1873, 1874, from a dollar, so it was dead on. It was right what it should be for a silver dollar. But by 1896, it was 52 cents. After that, it went to like to 49 cents. So the amount of silver in a silver dollar is only worth 50 cents. Well, what's the overall result of the Bland-Allison Act? Well, it did increase the money supply. It helped deflation, so prices helped to stabilize a tiny bit, not go down as much as they would have. But it was no help for the farmers because the foreign silver, which the farmers got, was still a commodity in both the United States and Europe. And they were still essentially getting 50 cents on the dollar of what they got before. And they couldn't do anything with these silver coins other than to sell them for the silver. Well, then they came up with the silver, Sherman Act in 1890. This was yet another attempt. Then the idea was the government would buy and mint more silver. In order to fund it, they issued notes which were redeemable in silver or gold. Here's what a $2 note looks like. Notice they could redeem this in coin. So the folks who had these notes, what were they going to redeem it for? You think they're going to redeem it for silver dollars? No, of course not. They're going to redeem it for gold. The speculators bought them. They redeemed them for gold. What did this do? It threatened the U.S. gold supply. So they had to repeal this, stop printing these things. And they finally thought, why did this really happen? And the Secretary of the Treasury almost went to prison because they thought, this was a scandal. He's just doing this to make his buddies rich. Well, what about the political scene? Well, the Democrats, who were the free silver folks, they wanted more money in the money supply. That was the party of the common man. William Jennings Bryan was their candidate in 1896. In his famous speech, The Cross of Gold, he said, "Ye shall not press down upon the brow of labor with this crown of thorns. Ye shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." But it was too late. The toothpaste was out of the tube. There was no way to get this back. One fellow said, "This should be undone by honest men." Well, it would take a whole lot more than honesty. It would take a tremendous amount of wealth to remonetize silver, and there was just no backbone to do that. Well, who did this? The financiers of England, because of greed, selfishness, mistrust. England readily admits that its monetary policy is purely selfish. When you look at businessmen, I mean, the number one folks they're looking out is their own business. They're out for is their own business. The Coinage Act of 1873 was effected through bribery. Actually, a fellow was sent over here with $500,000 in cash, and he bribed the right people, made sure the legislation was going to go through. So it was, when he went back to England, he knew it was a sure thing. In Europe, from 1871 to 1879, they used their influence amongst all their family members. They were all related. All the kings were related. They thought, well, England's a pretty smart country. Why don't we do what they're doing? So they demonetized gold. And this really showed the ignorance of the kings and the politicians. It showed that they did not have godlike wisdom. It also showed that these kings and politicians and heads of nations were just the pawns in the hands of the financiers who were much wiser and much smarter and had been controlling things like this for centuries. Well, by 1914, the damage was done. The farmers were losing their confidence in their leaders. This was yet another nail in the coffin of the old idea of the divine right of kings, the old idea of church-state, the old idea of Christendom, and the old order itself. Well, all this sounds pretty bleak, doesn't it? It sounds like there are millions of people who are going to be damaged terribly by this thing happening. This is as the Gentile times were ending. But, you know, when you look at it, they're Gentile times, but they're sort of Jews and Gentiles. So if it's the end of Gentile times, or if they're ending, it's Jewish times should be beginning. Well, so what's the good news? Well, it turns out this wealth that was coming from all over the world to buy the manufacturing goods in England, it was coming into the English banks, it was in the hands of the English financiers, mainly the Rothschilds, Montefiore, and Hirsch. And what were they doing with this? Not all of it, but a portion of it. Baron Rothschild lends Turkey $40 million in gold for their war debt. And he says, well, I'll tell you what, I'd like the deed to Palestine as security for this loan. Turkey says, okay. So all of a sudden, they get Palestine. So all this gold is flowing to England, and then there's Palestine. Also, the Hirsch, Rothschild, Montefiore, millions. They spent millions for schools, industry, communities, land, infrastructure, as the Jews were returning to their promised homeland. Here's the good news. Now, you might ask, is there any justice in this? They essentially took half of the wealth of the world, and as it flowed into England. Is there justice in this? Well, if you look at the Jews throughout the centuries and centuries and centuries in Christendom, whenever a king or a local, royal one or noble, whenever he had squandered his money in whatever foolish way, the way he'd get it back is he'd say, oh, look at those Jews. They're to blame for this. They're to blame for that. There are all sorts of accusations. So the Jews would be persecuted, killed. But along the way, they'd rob them of their lands, whatever they had, their possessions, their monies, and they'd be expelled from the country. And then about 8 or 10 years later, they didn't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. They would let them back into the country, but they would charge them a fee to return, just so another 40 or 50 years they could do it all again. And this happened again and again and again. Here's the history. Here's a partial history of the Jewish expulsions, the year and the place. There's not time to go through all this, but look at how many times this happens. Again and again and again and again and again. So when we look at the overall flow of gold and wealth, this is a 1914 map of the world, and the shaded areas are these little shaded areas. The colors show that this is English-speaking, pink English-speaking from London, etc. But that it shows essentially nations that were colonies of the nations of Europe. Well, the gold flow of gold from all over the world, that's going into England to buy their manufactured goods. And where does it go from there? It goes to Palestine for the regathering of the Jews. It's used as a method to fulfill God's promises. Is there any precedent to this? Well, we find that back in the days of Joseph, the wealth of Egypt really came from God. Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dream because the information was given to him by God. So the 7 years of plenty, the grain was stored. During the 7 years of famine, the wealth then flowed into Egypt. God essentially sent the gold with Israel when they left. So the gold flows into Egypt. And then God says, well, when you go, you'll not go out empty. You shall spoil the Egyptians. So he'd already done the same thing before. God keeps his promises. It shall no longer be said, the Lord liveth that brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt with the gold. But the Lord liveth that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from all the lands whither he had driven them, and I will bring them again into their land that I gave unto their fathers. And God is not an impractical entity. He knows what is necessary. He knows they're going to need food, they're going to need money, they're going to need infrastructure. And he provides this economic upheaval to provide the funding for Zionism. Well, after the Great War, the failed monetary policy in this country and other countries continued. It eventuated in the Great Depression. In the Great Depression, they contracted the money supply again because they didn't understand the value of money versus goods and services. Depression, unemployment. In Germany, because of the war reparations, what they did is they just printed more money. It caused hyperinflation, a bushel basket of printed money to buy a loaf of bread. All this caused World War II again because the world had not figured out its basic economic problems. But afterwards, we have the Marshall Plan. This is the first time in history where the country that has conquered the enemies, now he turns around and helps them. So there won't be wars again. Better monetary policy. The gold standard was gone. Actually, gold standard was used for international trade, but that ended in 1972. So you might ask, well, what backs our money today? What does it? Here I've got a dollar. What backs this up? Just paper. You can't turn this in for gold or silver. You used to be able to, but not anymore. What backs it up? Just a piece of paper. Well, it's not gold. You buy candy bars. In fact, I saw 3 for $1 recently. So this is a chocolate-based economy we have. Sister Karen is kind of happy about that. We have a chocolate-based economy. Or cars or clothes or hotel rooms or whatever you buy. It's what you buy. That's what the value of your money is. That's why for a responsible economy, they have to measure and monitor the GDP, the GNP. You might ask, well, why do they care about this? You hear these numbers every month. Well, they have to expand and contract the money supply. That's what the Federal Reserve does in various ways. So they monitor the amount of money in the system and the goods and services in the system so that the value of the dollar remains somewhat constant. But they've also realized that a tiny bit of inflation is good because it makes people borrow money, because they realize they'll be able to repay. If there was deflation, when you borrow money, you'd notice it was so hard to repay later, you wouldn't borrow any. That's essentially what they do. So a good economy will have just a touch of inflation. Well, looking at the cries of the reapers in God's plan, the cries of the reapers was absolutely unstoppable. God used this to shake Christendom to the bone. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth. And the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton, but behold, now the judge standeth at the door. In Revelation 18:5, for her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Christendom was going down. And the cries of the reapers is just one of the methods, one of the tools that God used to accomplish his glorious ends. May the Lord add his blessing.